Hello, welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me, the first part of the program, I have Daniel McGlynn. He's a USU ecologist, and he's been working on a project and a recently published article in the journal Nature about how plants survive the winter and how they've adapted to that. And I hope you'll join our conversation today. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your comment there. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I really, when I saw this last week, it was published in Utah State Today talking about the Nature article. I thought, I've got to have you on because this is really fascinating to me. I interviewed Dan Drost, the USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, last year about why plants like tomatoes not survive the cold, but yet my cruciferous vegetables like my broccoli and cabbage, they withstand it quite a bit. So that's why I wanted to look at this. So why don't we back up and describe what Earth was like 150 million years ago?
Sure. So 150 million years ago is really interesting in terms of plants because that's when we think the first flowering plants appeared on the scene. They first evolved. And so these are plants that actually produce a flower with pollen that are insect pollinated. And that early time in Earth's history was relatively warm and very moist. And so these early plants in this really moist climate tended to be a woody plant, and they also tended to grow very tall, have large, basically, vessels that conduct a lot of water very rapidly, and they also tended to be evergreen. So that means that they kept their leaves all year round. And so from this early evolutionary state, we now know that flowering plants have a really wide diversity of structures. Some plants drop their leaves. They have different vascular systems. And so what we were interested in this study was understanding how some of this diversity evolved in flowering plants. And in particular, we were really interested in how freezing poses a really strong evolutionary stress and how that might be responsible for some of the patterns we see in plants today.
So how were these plants reproducing 150 million years ago?
So primarily, most of the plant life was what we would refer to as a conifer or coniferous. So conifers are things like your Christmas tree. They produce small cones. They do release pollen, but they don't have the same flowering structure that, and they don't use insects. That's the really key thing. They were primarily wind pollinated. The usage of insects was really key because this allows plants to ensure that their pollen is carried to other individuals and increases genetic diversity in the population. This ability to have greater genetic diversity in your population is really important if you're going to adapt very rapidly. And so that's one of the reasons this novel evolutionary concept of the flower that really allowed these plants to become very diverse and very successful. They now inhabit all parts, you know, all habitats of the earth, and they're the most diverse group of plants.
And you don't see, like ferns or another one that are not part of that group that they're still around, but
sure. There
certainly seem to be a lot more flowering plants than there are the other ones.
Exactly. And ferns are a great example. You know, they're releasing spores into the environment. And so, again, that's a wind-dispersed thing, wind kind of pollinated thing. And so, yes, you know, they definitely were the dominant plants in the Cretaceous period. But once these flowering plants started to evolve, they really became major players in plant diversity relatively rapidly.
So there are different ways that your study has discovered that the plants adapted. So why don't you talk about those different adaptations?
Sure. So we really investigated three key adaptations with respect to climate that have been thought to be important for a long time. One of these is the fact that some flowering plants can drop their leaves, or in other words, they can be deciduous. So if you look outside right now here in Utah, you can see a lot of our trees have lost their leaves. And this, we thought early on, would probably be an adaptation to freezing tolerance. Another adaptation that I've already alluded to is the size of the vessels, or the chamber, you know, basically the conduits of water in the plants. And if you have a really large conduit, that's relatively sensitive to freezing. And so,
why is that?
The potential problem with freezing in large conduits is that you can get pockets of air in the conduit, and then that pocket of air can travel up and basically essentially block that pipe from being able to transfer water. So if you get enough pockets of air in your vascular system for these plants, they basically become drought stressed, essentially.
So this is what happens in your Christmas tree if you don't cut off the end and stick it right into the water. If the water gets down below the bottom, the air gets up into that system and basically keeps the tree from taking up the water.
Yeah, and a similar thing, you know, when the first cold weather in your garden hits and the plants look completely wilted, that's really actually a response to losing its water primarily. And then, you know, if you get a nice warm day and some of these plants, like you mentioned, the crucifers are relatively tolerant, they'll perk back up if it warms up and that kind of thing. So that's both drought and cold kind of have this similar pathway to stressing the plant, because they're basically causing that vascular system to cease to function. And so that was one of the adaptations we're really interested in. The last one was whether or not you are a woody plant or an herbaceous plant. So as I mentioned, we think that these early Cretaceous plants were primarily woody, but now we see a lot of flowering plants that are herbs, like tulips. Most of your garden plants, for example, are herbaceous. Basil is a great example that I love. And this herbaceousness is basically a great adaptation if it's going to get extremely cold outside. So you can overwinter either as an underground bulb or as a seed. And so we wanted to see if these three adaptations were things that the ancestors of modern-day flowering plants had before they moved into cold freezing zones or after the fact. That's really one of the things we wanted to do, was both to assess how important these adaptations are and their ordering through time.
So what did you find out?
So the key things we found out were that all three of those adaptations were really important, and that the interesting thing was deciduousness actually evolved after the fact. So after these early plants migrated northward and started to be exposed to freezing, they started to drop their leaves, and that became a hardwired genetic signal.
So the stress of the cold is what set that one off.
That's right.
Okay.
However, with respect to the two other adaptations, so the size of the chambers, plants that tended to have smaller vessels and plants that tended to be herbaceous, or clades that tended to be herbaceous, were more likely to move into the temperate zone than others. So those adaptations actually evolved in the tropics before moving into the temperate zone.
So that's why we don't have plants like palm trees in Logan, Utah, and other tropical plants?
Yeah, so some of these tropical plants that you're maybe thinking of, within their family, or their clade is how we refer to it, there was probably very little likelihood of having an herbaceous adaptation or having small vascular systems. Because of that, it was very difficult we basically had a very low probability that these clades would evolve those traits and then move into the temperate zone, because it was just the climate was too severe for them.
So some of them have had longer to adapt, and so that's why it happened before the cold hit. The cold starts hitting, and those plants that were able, that already had that adaptation,
yes,
able to survive.
With respect to the herbaceousness and the vascular system, that definitely appears to be true based on our analysis.
Okay. And what about those plants that just went underground? Is that also adaptation to the cold?
It absolutely is. We weren't able to investigate. I think it'd be really interesting to look at the size of the tuber or the bulb and see how that played a role. This was a really large-scale analysis of plants. So we had about 30,000 species in our analysis, which is unprecedented for this kind of study. And so we were a bit limited on the kinds of traits that we had consistently across all of that plant diversity. But bulbs, I think, and the presence of the bulbs and how large they are and the different kinds of adaptations that they might have would be another really interesting way to kind of dig into this herbaceous adaptation and try to parse it apart a little bit more.
Does having the ability to reproduce via flowers have an advantage over those that don't, other than just being able to be into the colder climate?
Yeah, so I would say actually having flowers itself doesn't necessarily pre-adapt you to being able to tolerate colder climates. In fact, our non-flowering plants, our conifers, are very well adapted to freezing. I mean, look at the mountainside outside here in Utah. It's mostly, especially when you go up in elevation, it's mostly conifers. I should just mention conifers have specially adapted vascular systems that are extremely narrow and very resistant to drought and freezing. That being said, flowers are really critical for organisms because they allow what we refer to as outcrossing. So they allow plants to basically ensure their genetic material goes from their individual to another individual, and therefore they're not inbreeding with themselves. What this allows, and also the fact that there's a pollinator intimately linked to the transfer of this pollen, is really important because that pollinator will ensure that that pollen is carried further away in space, ensuring that there's less relatedness to the individuals that pollen eventually ends up with. All of this does, it's just like with humans. If you were to breed with someone in your family, that wouldn't be very advantageous for your offspring. However, if you breed, you have this hybrid vigor, if you breed with someone from a different culture, you're going to have much more likely to have genetic resistance for various diseases. Potentially, the dominant alleles that are really helpful become expressed in that population. So you're getting greater diversity and you're avoiding inbreeding deficiencies. And so that's some of the things that flowering really allowed these plants to evolve much more rapidly in adaptation to stresses and to show much greater diversity across ecosystems.
Well, let's talk about the project then. There was this need to know, why did the plants do this? How did it get started? Because there were 50 people working on this project, and as we were talking before the program, it started out with a grant among a few, and then how did you become involved with it?
Yeah, so this was a really exciting project for me to participate in because this isn't necessarily my primary research. It was really kind of a side project. But it was through the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, which is an NSF-funded center in Durham, North Carolina. And this was an example of what we refer to as a working group in science. So a working group is just a collection of scientists. In this case, we had, I think, 23 co-authors on the paper. And we accumulated at different times. And we all came together to try to address the tempo and mode of plant evolution. We were really interested in that as a kind of guiding theme. And so to address that theme, we started accumulating really large databases. And this project is kind of, its contribution is providing three key databases to the scientific community. One is the largest phylogenetic tree or time tree, which is a map of relatedness amongst plants. So we created the largest time tree We also created really large databases of plant traits, so things like the herbaceousness or woodiness and the vascular systems, as well as many other adaptations that we have data on. And then lastly, the last database we created was the climate and distribution data, and that's what I contributed to the project. So my contribution was really trying to understand where this really broad array of species occurred on the Earth. And to do that, I processed about 47 million records.
So how will this be used? I mean, we talked before the program about this tree and how you said it's still incomplete.
That's right.
How open is it? Can other scientists and researchers add their knowledge into it?
Absolutely. So I should say first, the tree was built from data on GenBank. So this is a repository of all scientists are contributing their genetic data to this. So without that open data, we could have never created this tree. So we used that data from GenBank as well as what we'll refer to as a backbone, so a really good hypothesis as to what the early relationships between plants were. And then we posted on top of that backbone this new information provided to us by GenBank. And that created this really large map of relatedness amongst the plants. We have that this tree is completely open and available to anyone that's interested. It's posted with our paper as a supplemental material. And I should emphasize, it is incomplete. It only has 30,000 taxa. Flowering plants are much more diverse than that. However, it is very broad in its diversity. And one thing that we can, that is useful, the tree is still very useful even though it's incomplete, because close relatives tend to be very similar in plant life. And so even though we might not have all the species, we have sampled the plant diversity quite broadly, and so we can still say quite a bit about the total extent of adaptations and the placement of those adaptations on the tree.
So you may not have an onion in there, but maybe you have something else in the allium family?
That's right, exactly. Okay. Yeah, most likely we do have onion.
Well, if you have any questions or comments, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Daniel McGlynn is a USU ecologist, and we're talking about a paper that was recently published in the journal Nature about how plants have adapted to the cold. So I'm thinking also the opposite direction with global warming and so forth, as the planet cycles back into a warmer climate. So what are these plants going to do going back the other way? I mean, that's it hasn't happened yet, so we don't know for sure, but why don't you give me your best guess?
You know, that's a great question and something our group has been thinking about. We might try to tackle with some future papers. So, you know, one of the adaptations that we looked at in this current paper was, as I mentioned, the size of the vascular system. And I also mentioned that that's important both with respect to freezing and drought. And so with global climate change, one of the things we're really expecting, in addition to this slow warming, is rapid increases in variance in climate. So more likely to have droughts, more likely to have floods. And these swings, and really rapid swings in drought stress, could have a big negative impact on plants that have larger vessel systems, basically. Those large vessel systems are great when water is very abundant. You know, you can be really efficient and very competitive for resources. However, if you get knocked back by those drought stress, that could have a really be very detrimental for a lot of plant diversity. And so that's one of the things that we can start to look at is not only which of those clades or which families of plants are more likely to be potentially susceptible to drought stress, but also where they occur on the earth. And so that's definitely a future project that I think our group might dig into.
I'm just thinking about my vegetable garden and how a zucchini or a squash plant just has a huge vascular system and a little bit of stress or a little bit of cold just gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gone, but it's been able to continue because of seed. You know, but it's not one that goes below ground. It's just an annual. So anyway, a lot of great questions, a lot of great answers. I look forward to the project continuing. So there'll be some other published papers.
Yeah, we have a paper coming out February 5th that looks at the basically what we refer to as shifts happen. And so we were looking at all the major evolutionary shifts in plant diversity across 7 or 8 different key traits, and that'll be in the Journal of Ecology. So,
now I have one last question for you.
Sure.
How do you get this specialized?
Well, I guess, you know, I was always really interested in plants and natural ecosystems since I was a kid. However, it wasn't until I was really in college that I started to realize that there was this whole discipline of ecology and that there's rules that we can kind of decipher about how ecosystems work. That really fascinated me. And I started doing undergraduate research. That's a great way to kind of get your foot wet and to see, hey, is this something that could work for me? I loved it. And so I went on and got my PhD, and it kind of the rest is just kind of leading me down this path.
Well, we're grateful to have you here at Utah State University, and thanks for coming
in. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Daniel McGlynn, USU ecologist, has been talking about a recently published paper in the journal Nature about how plants have adapted to the cold. Basically, the plant getting the plant's winter parka is how I saw it mentioned in an article. And I'm sure we'll have more information as more articles get published. And you've been listening to Access with to Zesty Garden. We'll be coming up in the second half of the program and talking with Shane Taylor of Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me on the line from Salt Lake City is Shane Taylor from Cactus and Tropicals. And we're going to talk about a couple of different topics, but the first one I wanted to explore was taking care of your poinsettia now that you've still got it in your home. Shane, thanks for joining me on the program.
Good morning, Brian. Glad to be here.
Well, it's been a couple of years since we last spoke, but I've been into Cactus and Tropicals, and I thought, you know, let's have Shane on. We haven't talked in a while, and I was looking at my own poinsettia sitting on the table and wondering, okay, how do I want to extend this? I've learned from past experience that I don't want to keep it to try to keep it to the next year because it was just way too much work. I mean, I got it to rebloom, but it just never looked quite the same. So I don't want to go that far, but how can I keep my poinsettia looking well for at least a couple more weeks?
Well, one of the things to consider is as a poinsettia finishes its flowering period, it's actually waking up a bit. When poinsettias are blooming, they're pretty much kind of in a dormant state where they don't do a whole lot of active growth. The plant really isn't doing anything other than trying to attract pollinators and make seeds. So when that starts ending and you do start seeing that new growth out, it's a good idea to move your poinsettia into a brightly lit location. Now, these plants, they're forest floor plants, so they don't need a whole lot of really strong direct sun, but they do prefer a really bright location, and that's sometimes a tricky thing in the house. But if you can get them in a good, brightly lit room, maybe near a window, maybe even with a little bit of morning sun or late evening sun, and then just, watching your water, doing a lot of what you've been doing through the holiday season with trying to let the surface dry out but not letting the soil go completely dry all the way through, they can last for quite a while. And, in fact, some people do keep them season after season and sometimes are able to get them to rebloom by using some tricks of the light and also using some fertilizers and other things to encourage them to produce those big flowering bracts once again.
Well, they're so inexpensive that unless you just savor the challenge, it's not worth it.
Yeah. It is one of those things. Most people, they enjoy them, and then they're destined for their compost heap afterwards, and it is hard. It's always hard, a plant that you enjoy, to throw away. And I very much appreciate the fact that there are people who are willing to at least give it a try and see what they can do.
I've got to say, my mother's green thumb has always dictated to me, genetically, I feel, that you don't throw anything out. And the poinsettia was the only thing I finally succumbed to, but everything else I pretty well hold on to. So with the one that I've got, it's been in the kitchen, which is on the north side of my house. Have I already done it lethal damage? It still looks pretty good. I could stick it into my living room, which is on the south side and gets a ton of light.
Well, that will just allow the new growth that will occur to develop a little bit healthier. If it looks good, then it's okay. That's a good rule of thumb with a plant is unless it's a slow-growing plant like a cactus, looks will definitely be a good first indicator of the health of the plant. And if the if a poinsettia looks good, it's healthy.
Should I be giving it any fertilizer at all?
During this time of growth, you could give it something with a little bit more nitrogen in it, because that's what it will be using at this point. So something with, when you're looking at packages of fertilizers, of course, you see those three numbers on the package, and the first number is going to be the nitrogen. And using a fertilizer with a slightly higher nitrogen level helps. Also, to acidify the soil a little bit, to help it feel like it's in that forest environment, that helps as well. And a lot of purely nitrogen fertilizers are also acidic fertilizers. You can do some natural fertilizing, though, with your old coffee grounds. I know a lot of people who are very successful with those. Save some of your coffee grounds, and on occasion, work some of those into the soil, and as they break down, they will release some of those organic nutrients as well as acidify the soil, which makes the plant happy.
So these plants are growing in a forest, a tropical forest?
Mexico, yeah. So subtropical to tropical, forest floor dwellers. So again, plants that grow on the forest floor are going to be a little bit more prone to sunburn and to damage if you get them in a really hot, sunny spot. They won't do as well as if they're just in a really well, brightly lit location.
Can they be grown outdoors anywhere in the U.S.?
There are actually varieties of ornamental poinsettias that make great annual bedding plants, here, even here in Utah. And we bring them in the shop every spring just for the beautiful color of the leaves, not even for their flowers, but just for the fact that they're just such bright, vibrant colors to stick in a container that you're not needing to overly feed to get that great color.
Do they work better than a caladium? I just had the worst luck with trying to grow caladiums.
You know, caladiums are so sensitive. I'd say they're maybe a step up from a caladium. They're not too far in the better direction, because caladiums are so sensitive to cold, which a lot of the poinsettias are as well. So you got to be careful about how early in the season that you plant them. But caladiums also have some other issues where when they wilt, when they get a little bit too dry, caladium will wilt, and when you water it, the stem, as it pulls that water into the stem, will then solidify into the wilted position. So your plant will always look wilted once it wilts.
And I'm a lazy gardener, and that's what I always found out. I'm like, okay, these things just aren't going to look good in my garden.
Yeah, and poinsettias don't do that. So
would you still grow a poinsettia in a shady area?
Yes, definitely. They would be intended for shade gardens, along with begonias and impatiens and plants like that.
And for indoors, when you start seeing leaves dropping off on the bottom, is that going to be natural, or are you doing something you shouldn't be?
I would say that's fairly normal. And you see that a lot of times on any kind of plant that's adjusting from a higher light living environment to a lower light living environment, because what it's going to want to do is only sustain enough of its foliage that's necessary for the amount of light that it's receiving. So when it's being grown, these poinsettias are grown in these giant greenhouses that are brightly lit, and they've got just the perfect amount of light. You know, they've got shades above them so they don't get too much direct sun, but it's usually much brighter than our home. And so poinsettias will start shedding from the lower portions of the plant, and that actually you'll see on a variety of different houseplants when you perhaps just bring them home from the shop, or the seasons are changing from the brighter summer days to the darker winter days, is you'll notice plants tend to shed from the bottom up or from the inside out when they're just adjusting. And that's okay. If your poinsettia starts shedding from the top down, that means you've got major problems.
Hmm. And logically, how long do you think, if you're not going to keep a poinsettia until the next year, how long do we think we should be able to expect to keep it if we water it and fertilize it as well as it should be?
Well, I think that varies.
Yeah.
But it kind of comes down to the how long can you stand to keep it. A lot of people, just with basic care, you can keep them around for quite a while. But then again, you know, it's like keeping the Christmas tree up or keeping a wreath on your door or something like that, I think it becomes more a symbol of it's so much a symbol of the holiday season that people trying to move on tend to get sick of them before they actually end up killing them and throw them out at that point. But people who are plant enthusiasts who want to see how long they can keep them, I know people who have poinsettias that are years old.
Really? And I mean, how much do they grow? I mean, how big are they?
They'll grow to a point where the best thing to do with them is the thing that you do with any plant, and that's you're going to prune them back and keep them small. No houseplant do you really want to just let go and go and go, because plants will tend to get leggy and ugly looking. If you just let a poinsettia go, I'd imagine it would attain a height of maybe 3 or 4 feet before it starts busting itself apart. They get top heavy, and their stems really aren't all that strong.
If you do keep it, as far as pot-wise, when it starts to get big, how do you know when to repot it?
Well, the best thing with most houseplants is keep the plants comfortable. Don't up pot plants unless it's time. So a good rule of thumb is stick your finger down in the soil or stick a pencil down in the soil and see exactly how dense the root material is. And you want it to reach kind of a happy medium where if you were to stick a pencil down, you'd meet some resistance. You know, it wouldn't be impossible to push the pencil into the soil, but you'd feel some pushback from those roots. And another thing, if you want to be even more brave, is you'd actually lift the root ball out of the pot and take a look up and down the outsides and see how dense the roots have become. And any time that you're noticing a houseplant, that the root percentage in your pot is probably 75% or greater, and you've only got about 25% soil, that is heading into the root-bound area, and it's ready to be moved. But most of the time, we'll notice that our houseplants will be maybe less than 50% rooted into their containers at any given time. And a common mistake we hear about is people take a plant home and they will transplant it up immediately from a 6-inch diameter pot, and then they'll stick in a big 10-inch diameter pot. And all that loose extra soil around the root ball ends up holding water like a sponge and will end up causing the roots to rot. It keeps them too wet. So just being very conservative about the amount of times that you transplant a plant really helps it to stay more comfortable and happy in your house.
Okay. Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Shane Taylor is on the line with us from Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake. And if you have an indoor plant question, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your comment or question there, or go to our Zesty Garden Gmail address, zestygarden@gmail.com, and send your question there. We have only about 6 minutes left before we have to move on to the next segment, so get your questions or comments in soon. I wanted to ask you, Shane, about something that I had never really thought about before. I mean, I've heard the word terrarium, but now I'm seeing a vivarium. And basically, there's different types of vivariums, of which terrariums are one. Why don't you talk about what a vivarium is?
Well, a terrarium is the basic version of a vivarium. Terrariums are contained growing environments for plants. So like a fish tank with plants in it, or a small glass globe or something like that. Terrariums were very popular back in the 60s and 70s, and they're actually making quite a comeback right now as a good way to keep difficult-to-grow plants. And vivariums just take that a step further. A vivarium adds animals into the mix. So people who are enthusiastic about collecting poison dart frogs or chameleons or stuff like that, creating a little habitat for them to live in, that would be what a vivarium is.
And how large can these be? I guess you can have them as large as you want.
Yeah, they could be huge. Generally, you want to be able to control the factors within. So the bigger they get, the more difficult that can be. One of the gentlemen that that worked here for quite a while was very knowledgeable about putting these together, and he'd make beautiful fish tank where they're 4 or 5 feet wide, maybe 3 feet high, and a foot or two deep, and it would just be neat to watch the balance of everything, how they got the soil and the water and the plants to live together in such a way that you don't have a bunch of mold or fungus or rot or stuff like that going on inside.
So a vivarium could be as large as, say, a biosphere like the one in Oracle, Arizona. I'm also thinking of maybe, would it be considered a vivarium if, like the bird sanctuary at, there's a museum in Tucson that's just full of birds and trees and things, and it's all enclosed.
Oh, we have the Sonoran Desert Museum. Yeah, they are, I would say they're, there's probably a different term once they get into building size, whereas vivariums are probably going to be more looked at as being something as large as a piece of furniture. But
so what do you need to have in a vivarium to make it work? What are the very basics if someone wants to get started?
The very basics is you need something to put it in. You need a container that is closable, containable, where you can create this enclosed ecosystem, and you need to be able to provide a potting medium or something for the plants to actually put their roots into that will give them enough nutrient. But like many potting soils that have a lot of different little types of bacteria and fungal spores and stuff like that in there, you've got to use a potting medium that's limited with the amount of microbes and fungus and stuff in there so that you don't breed an excess amount of bacteria or fungus. So in the past, I've seen vivariums planted with clay pellets or that shredded cocoa fiber as the potting medium. And then the last two pieces of the puzzle are the plants. What you put in there needs to be appropriate for the animals that you're going to have as well. So making sure the enthusiasts that come into the shop looking for plants for their poison dart frogs are often looking for bromeliads, which are a beautiful epiphytic plant that grow up on trees in the rainforest. And they're looking for different types of ferns and different types of philodendrons, and ideally stuff that won't get too large in this contained environment, because plants in a high humidity environment with access to moisture, and of course the animals in there, as they live, they're actually producing, you know, as they poop in the soil, that's part of the ecosystem that's giving the plants fertilizer. So plants will grow like weeds in vivariums and terrariums.
So how do you keep enough moisture in there? I mean, is it you just start out? Do you have like a small water feature that's inside of it? And because it's an enclosed environment, it just kind of recycles itself?
That you can do that. Adding a water feature into the environment will keep a lot of water. So if you want a really moist vivarium, you can use a water feature. The cocoa fiber and the clay pellets will actually absorb quite a bit of water, and you'll end up with this sort of this feedback of the plants pull the water out of the cocoa fiber, they push it through the plant, they push it out of their leaves, and you end up with humidity, which then goes back into the soil. So one of the biggest dangers is not adding, it's adding too much water to the system. You got to be careful just to add the right amount so that it can keep that sort of cycle going on. I actually have experimental terrariums that I work on that do not have any animals. They just have plants in them. And I've got some enclosed terrariums that have now been closed with no water added for about 7 months now.
Wow. And so when you have too much, what are the signs of you've got too much water in there? You've got mold algae growing on the side of the terrarium?
Yep, you get algae, you'll get mold. You'll notice that the plants will start dying. You'll get a lot of yellowing. Plants will turn mushy and just go limp. It really is one of those things that if you balance it just right from the beginning, you'll end up with a very low maintenance system on your hands.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Thanks for spending a little bit of time with me this morning and talking about poinsettias and vivariums.
Well, thanks, Brian. I look forward to doing it again sometime.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Shane Taylor is with Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City, and we'll be having him on in the future talking about different household plants to have in your house or not to have in your house. Coming up next is the latest from Petals and Pros with Helen Cannon.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Pros, and I want to begin a series of conversations with you about roses. And I'll begin with this quotation from a delightful book called Peacock Manure and Marigolds by Janet Gillespie. She begins, "One June day when I was young, single, and romantic, I had a flat tire on a road in France. It was a bicycle tire, and my friend and I, being typical females, trudged off on foot to hunt for a man, in capitals, to fix it. We went down a white, dusty lane toward a clump of trees and a tower, and there, most appropriately, was an old chateau. The lawns had grown up to hay fields. The gardens were smothered. Climbing roses ran wild over everything, filling the air with fragrance. The caretaker's wife appeared in an advanced state of pregnancy and asked us if we'd like to go inside. When we said yes, she produced an iron key and unlocked the great door. The hall beyond and all the visible rooms were in a state of indescribable chaos. Antique furniture, velvet drapes, gilt clocks, portraits, old clothes, garden tools were tumbled together in a hellish confusion, and over all was a snowstorm of letters. Letters, letters, letters. Some black-edged, some tied up with blue ribbon, some trampled in the dust. I picked up one written on crested paper, edged with black. The writing was angular and precise, the hand of a lady. It was not a letter. It was a list of old roses. I have the list by me now, since I took it away with me. The reason had something to do with the lady who wrote it. I saved a bit of her, perhaps. Later, we were shown the half-finished ballroom where roses tumbled through windows and arched over the room exactly like those in pictures of Sleeping Beauty's castle. What had happened? I didn't want to sound sentimental, although I am, but that list was my reason for growing roses. I didn't grow the hybrid teas and the hybrid perpetuals very long. I didn't like their bushes, but I grew them for what that unknown marquise or countess or whatever she was. Now, if there's one plant that is disease and insect prone, it's the rose, especially the hybrid teas. People will agree reluctantly that you may get along without spraying vegetables or even perennial borders, but roses, no. Since I took this book, messages arrive by word of mouth, all saying about the same thing. Tell Jan that if she thinks she can grow roses without spraying or dusting, she's crazy. I may be crazy, but I can grow some roses without spraying or dusting. I can grow, or one can grow, most roses with some spraying and dusting. You can grow some of the roses all of the time, all of the roses some of the time, but not all of the roses all of the time without dusting or spraying. This makes me think of a wonderful woman who lives in the valley and knows flowers and very, very well. Her name is Joan Shaw, and she lives in Lewiston, Utah, in what had been the first birthing home in the valley. If you look at Joan's online writings about different flowers, just if you consider her garden essays, her essays on roses alone come to about 19. I'll give you the titles of some of them. A New Rose Book for Your Shelf, Early Spring Roses, Roses in Sunset Colors, Miniature Rose Garden in Utah, Cascading Roses, Old White Roses, Pink Autumn in the Rockies Roses, Prolific Climbing Roses in the North, and it goes on and on. So her website, she calls her garden Dragon Goose Farm. and her website you would look for under dragongoose.com. And I just wanted to read a little bit of Joan's writing about roses. The essay is called A New Rose Book for Your Shelf, A Rose by Any Name. The first serious rose book I read was one by the famous rosarian and writer Graham Stuart Thomas. I'd been collecting and planting old roses beginning in the 70s, one of which was a favorite in the California nursery catalog, Roses of Yesterday. I started out with mostly cold hardy roses that could take frigid winters in far northern Utah. I treasured this and other catalogs of old roses that I'd found on the internet, not only for the plants they offered, but also for their helpful information on classification and cultivation. These catalogs led me to several rose dictionaries, such as the Ultimate Rose Book, a several-pound monster of a tome that rose enthusiasts with weak wrists would be smart to store on a library stand, as I do. And then, deciding to get serious, I sent for and read the above-mentioned, the Graham Stuart Thomas Rose Book. One of the roses described in this book was a David Austin introduction, a climber that was his first attempt in the development of his English rose line. Having the characteristics of old roses with modern vigor and disease resistance, he named the introduction Constant Spry, honoring an English designer, decorator, writer, and lecturer who is credited with turning around the art of arranging flowers and gardens into an easy cottage style that is still current. Since the Thomas book moved into our home, like clothes hangers that seem to reproduce by themselves in closets, rose books have proliferated like dandelions along my shelves. In addition, I've found internet sites on roses through Google search. Often these old varieties are found roses cultivated from taking roses around abandoned houses and cemeteries. It seems that in the early 20th century, decorating followed the staid Edwardian style, extending even to flower arrangements in which anything other than stems of the same flower decorously arranged in vases was looked upon as vulgar. She goes on to tell about the York and the Lancaster, a fascinating history of roses, the York and Lancaster, describing the drawn-out wars of the roses starting in the 1400s. Here is the author's cogent description of those wars. After a spat between two of England's royal families about who deserved to wear the crown, the authors talk of the type of roses each wore on their standards. York's white, believed to be Alba sempiplena, and Lancaster's red, believing to be Rosa gallica. After these decade-long wars finally wound down, a truce was called, and an emblem chosen by both sides as a symbol of their newly found amity, York and Lancaster rose. I wanted to read from another book dealing with some of these roses, A Natural History of the Senses by Diane Ackerman, and she too talks about the peace rose. The most popular hybrid tea in the world is a peace, a stunning multicolored pastel with sunset hues that shriek at noon and grow muted at sunset and record all the phantoms of light during the day. Its egg-shaped buds open into large pale yellow ruffles with the translucent tips that are often flushed with pink, and it smells like sugared leather dipped in honey. Of all my roses, the peace seems to have the most human complexion and human moods, depending on the moisture and the light of the day. An experimental rose, it was named on May 2nd, 1945, the day Berlin fell, and the Pacific Rose Society of Pasadena, because of this greatest new rose of our time, should be named the greatest desire, peace. Many presidents have had roses named after Lincoln's is blood red, John Kennedy's is pure white. Another writer about flowers, wonderful writer, in her book, Green Thoughts by an Hungarian writer, writes, "Peace has a romantic story. It was bred by the distinguished French house of Meilhan in 1939 when Francis Meilhan discovered in his nursery a ravishing rose growing from a single seed he had planted. He knew it had to be something extraordinary. The beginning of the war kept him from finding out exactly what. All he could do was to ship the unnamed, largely untested cuttings in all directions, hoping that one or another of them would safely arrive. These, consigned to the American grower Robert Pyle in Pennsylvania, were aboard the last plane to leave France in November 1940, a step ahead of the Nazi armies. Meilhan's waited for 4 years to learn its fate until August 1944, when a letter arrived from Pyle. Quote, whilst dictating this letter, he wrote, my eyes fixed in fascinated admiration on a glorious rose, a pale gold, cream and ivory petals blended to lightly ruffled edge of a delicate carmine. There it is before me, full of promise. I am convinced it will be the greatest rose of the century. He was right. Peace was skillfully promoted. On the day Berlin fell, it was given its name in a ceremony in California, attended by rose lovers from all over the country, in which doves were set free. When the delegates to the San Francisco conference arrived in their hotel rooms, each found a vase containing a single specimen of the peace rose. So these histories of roses, I myself try to grow fragrant roses because I like to make potpourri. And so a lot of the new roses had the scent bred out of them in order to develop some other traits, such as resistance to different problems that roses are subject to. So I hope to talk with you more about roses and future Petals and Prose. Thank you for listening. This is Helen Cannon.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the USU Extension 4-H and Youth Programs, assisting youth in acquiring knowledge, building character, and developing life skills in a learning environment. Information at utah4h.org.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.